If Robin had not fallen, the charge would have stove in her ribs and snapped her neck, for the lion was over 400 pounds weight of driving bone and muscle. As it was, it knocked her out of her senses, for she never knew how long, but she became conscious again with the strong cat reek of the lion in her nostrils and an immense weight crushing her into the sand. She wriggled weakly, but the weight was suffocating her, and gouts of hot blood, so hot it seemed to scald her, were spurting over her head and neck.
"No Musa!"
Juba's voice, high with anguish and very close, but those shattering roars were silent. There was just the unbearable weight and the rank smell of lion. Robin's strength came back to her with a rush, and she struggled and kicked, and the weight above her rolled loosely aside, slithering off her, and she dragged herself free of it. Immediately Juba clung to her again, throwing her arms about Robin's neck. Robin comforted her, as though she were an infant, patting her and kissing her cheek that was wet and hot with tears.
"It's over. There now, it's all over," she mumbled, aware that her hair was sodden with the lion's blood, and that a dozen men, led cautiously by the Hottentot corporal, had lined the high river bank, each of them holding aloft a torch of burning grass.
In the dim yellow light, the lion lay stretched out beside Robin in the sand. The ball from the musket had struck him full in the nose, passed cleanly through the brain and lodged in the base of his neck, killing the great cat in mid-air, so that the lifeless body had pinned Robin to the sand. "The lion is dead," Robin quavered as she called to the men, and they came down in a close bunch, timidly at first, and then boldly when they saw the huge yellow carcass.
"It was the shot of a true huntress," announced the corporal grandly. "An inch high and the ball would have bounced off the skull, an inch lower and it would have missed the brain."
"Sucky," Robin's voice still shook,
"where is Sucky?"
He was still alive, and they carried him in his blanket up into the camp. His wounds were fearsome, and Robin knew there was not the smallest chance of saving him. One arm from wrist to elbow had been chewed, so that not a piece of bone bigger than the top joint of her finger remained. One foot was gone just above the ankle, bitten clean off and swallowed in one piece. He had been bitten through pelvis and spine, while through a tear in his diaphragm below the ribs, the mottled pink of his lungs swelled out with each breath. Robin knew that to attempt to cut and sew that dreadfully torn flesh, or to saw the splintered bone stumps, would be inflicting futile agony on the little yellow man. She had him laid close to the fire. She plugged the worst holes gently, and then covered him with blankets and fur carosses. She administered a dose of laudanum, so powerful as to be almost lethal in itself. Then she sat next to Sucky and held his hand. "A doctor must know when to let a man die with dignity," her professor at St. Matthew's had once told her. And a little before dawn, Sucky opened his eyes, the pupils dilated widely by the massive dose of the drug, and smiled at her just once before he died. His brother Hottentots buried him in a small cave in one of the granite koppies, and they blocked the opening with boulders that the hyena could not roll aside. When the corporal and his Hottentots came down from the hill, they indulged in a brief ritual of mourning, which consisted mainly of emitting loud theatrical cries of anguish and firing their muskets in the air to speed Sucky's soul on its journey, after which they ate a hearty breakfast of smoked elephant meat, and the corporal came to Robin dry-eyed and grinning broadly. "We are now ready to march, Namuza," he told her, and with a stamp of his right foot, which began with the knee lifted under his chin, he gave her one of those widely extravagant salutes, a mark of deep respect that up to that date had been reserved exclusively for Major Zuga Ballantyne. During that day's march, the porters sang again for the first time since leaving Zuga's camp at Mount Hemden. "She is your mother and your father too. She will dress your wounds. She will stand over you while you sleep. We, your children, greet you, Namuza,
the girl child of mercy.
It was not only the caravan's rate of advance under Zuger that had irritated and annoyed Robin, it was also their complete failure to make contact with any of the indigenous tribes, with any of the inhabitants of the scattered and fortified villages. To her it seemed completely logical that the only way that they would be able to trace Fuller Ballantyne through this wilderness was by asking questions of those who must have seen him pass, and almost certainly had spoken and traded with him. Robin could not believe that her father would have adopted the same high-handed actions to force a passage past anybody or anything that stood in the way of the caravan as Zuger had done. When she closed her eyes, she could still see clearly in her mind's eye the tiny falling body of the black man in the tall headdress, shot down ruthlessly by her brother. She had rehearsed in her mind how she or her father would have passed through the elephant road without gunfire and slaughter. The tactful withdrawal, the offering of small gifts, the cautious parley, and eventual agreement. It was plain bloody murder, she repeated to herself for the 100th time. And what we have done since then has been blatant robbery. Zuger had helped himself to the standing crops of the villages they had passed, to tobacco, millet, and yams, not even bothering to leave a handful of salt or a few sticks of dried elephant meat as token payment. "We should try to communicate with these people, Zuger," she had remonstrated. "They are a sullen and dangerous people, because they expect you to rob and murder them. And as God is my witness, you have not disappointed them, have you?" The same argument had run its well-worn course many times, neither of them relenting, each holding stubbornly to their own view. Now at least she was free to attempt to establish contact with these people. Mashona, as Juba called them disparagingly, without her brother's impatience and arrogance to distract her and alarm the timid black people. On the fourth day after leaving Zuga's camp, they came in sight of an extraordinary geological formation. It was as though a high dam wall had been constructed across the horizon, a great dike of rock running almost exactly north and south to the very limit of the eye. Almost directly in their line of march, was the only breach in this rampart, and from the altered vegetation, the denser growth and deeper green, it was clear that a river flowed through the gap. Robin ordered a small adjustment in their line of march and headed for the pass. When they were still some miles distant, Robin was delighted to make out the first signs of human habitation that they had come across since leaving Mount Hamden. There were fortified walls on the cliffs above the breach in the long, low hill, high above the riverbed, and as they drew closer, Robin could see the gardens on the banks of the river, defended by high brush and thorn barriers, with little thatched lookout huts standing high on stilts in the centre of the dark, luscious green stands of young millet. "We will fill our bellies tonight," the Hottentot corporal gloated. "That corn is ripe enough to eat." "We will camp here, Corporal," Robin told him firmly. "But we are still a mile here," repeated Robin. They were all puzzled and resentful when Robin forbade entry to the tempting gardens and confined them all to the perimeter of the camp, except for the water and wood parties. But resentment turned to genuine alarm when Robin left the camp herself, accompanied only by Juba, and as far as they could see, completely unarmed. "These people are savages," the corporal tried to intercept her. "They will kill you, and then Major Zuger will kill me." The two women entered the nearest garden and carefully approached the lookout hut. On the earth below the rickety ladder that rose to the elevated platform, a fire had burned down to ash, but flared again when Robin knelt and fanned it. Robin threw a few dry branches upon it, and then sent Juba for an armful of green leaves. The column of smoke drew the attention of the watchers on the cliff above the gorge. Robin could see their distant figures on the skyline, standing very still and intent. It was an eerie feeling to know that so many eyes were upon them, but Robin was not relying entirely on the fact that they were women. Nor was she relying on their patently peaceful intentions, nor even upon the prayers which she had offered up so diligently to protect them.
On the principle that the Almighty helps those who show willing, she had Zuga's big Colt pistol stuffed into the waistband of her breeches and covered by the tail of her flannel shirt. Next to the smoking beacon fire, Robin left a half-pound of salt in a small calabash gourd and a bundle of sticks of black-smoked elephant meat, which was the last of her stock. Early the next morning, Robin and Juba again visited the garden and found the meat and salt had been taken, and that there were the fresh footprints of bare feet overlaying their own in the dust. "Corporal," Robin told the Hottentot, with a confidence she did not feel, "we're going out to shoot meat." Corporal grinned beatifically. They had eaten the last of the smoked meat, weevils and all, the previous evening, and he flung her one of his more flamboyant salutes, his right arm quivering at the peak of his cap, his fingers spread stiffly, the stamp of his right foot raising dust. Before he hurried away, shouting orders to his men to prepare for the hunt. Zuga had long ago declared the Sharp's rifle to be too light for elephant, and left it in camp, favouring the big 40-pound smooth bores to the more expensive breech-loading rifle. Robin took it now and inspected it with trepidation. Previously she had only fired it at a target, and now in the privacy of her grass hut she rehearsed loading and cocking the weapon. She was not sure that she would be capable of cold-bloodedly aiming it at a living animal, and had to reassure herself of the absolute necessity of procuring food for the many mouths and stomachs that now depended upon her. The corporal did not share her doubts. He had seen her shoot a charging lion between the eyes, and trusted her now implicitly. Within an hour's walk they found a herd of buffalo in the thick reed beds along the river. Robin had listened to Zuga talking of the hunt, with enough attention to know the necessity of keeping below the wind, and in the reeds with visibility down to a few feet, and with the commotion created by 200 cows and bleating calves, they crept up to a range at which nobody could miss. Her Hottentots blazed away with their muskets, while Robin herself fired grimly into the galloping, bellowing bodies that charged wildly past her after the first shot had startled them. After the dust had settled, and the thick bank of powder smoke had drifted away on the faint breeze, they found six of the big black animals lying dead in the reed beds. Her entourage were delighted, hacking the bodies into manageable chunks, which they slung on long poles and carried singing up to the camp. Their delight turned to amazement when Robin ordered that an entire haunch of fresh buffalo be taken out and left next to the hut in the millet garden. "These people are eaters of roots and dirt," Juba explained patiently. "Meat is too good for them." "To kill this meat we have risked our lives," the corporal began his protest, then caught the look in Robin's eye, broke off and coughed and shuffled his feet.
"Namuza, could we not give them a little less than a haunch? The hooves make a good stew, and these people are savages. They will eat anything," he pleaded.
"A whole haunch?"
She sent him away muttering and shaking his head sorrowfully. During the night Juba woke her, and the two of them sat and listened to the faint throb of drums and the singing that carried down from the hilltop village, clearly the sounds of feasting and jubilation.
"They have probably not seen so much meat at one time in all their lives," Juba murmured sulkily.
In the morning Robin found, in place of the buffalo meat, a bark basket containing 15 hen's eggs the size of pigeon's eggs, and 2 large earthen pots of millet beer. The look of the bubbling, thin grey gruel almost turned Robin's stomach. She gave the beer to the corporal to distribute, and her followers drank it with such obvious relish, smacking their lips and nodding over it like connoisseurs over an ancient bottle of claret, that Robin controlled her heaving stomach and tasted some. It was tart and refreshing, and strong enough to set the Hottentots chattering and laughing raucously. With Juba following her, each of them carrying a bundle of half-dried buffalo meat, Robin returned to the gardens, certain that the exchange of gifts had proved it possible to establish friendly contact. They sat under the shelter and waited. The hours passed without a sign of the Mashona appearing. The hushed heat of noon gave way to long, cool shadows of evening, And then, for the first time, Robin noticed a gentle stir amongst the millet plants that was neither wind nor bird.
"Do not move," she cautioned Juba.
Slowly, a human shape showed itself, a frail, bent figure dressed in tatters of a skin kilt. Robin could not tell whether it was a man or a woman, and she didn't dare stare openly at it, for fear of frightening it away. The figure emerged from the stand of millet, crouched down on its haunches, and it hopped hesitatingly towards them, with long pauses between each tentative hop. It was so thin and wrinkled and dried out that it looked like one of the unbandaged mummies that Robin had seen in the Egyptian section of the British Museum. It was definitely a man, she realized at last, sneaking a glance in his direction, for with each hop his shriveled and stringy genitals flapped out from under the short kilt. Closer still, Robin saw that his cap of woolly hair was pure white with age, and in the seamed and pouched sockets his eyes wept slow tears of fright, as though these were the last drops of liquid that his desiccated old body contained.